This is CliffCentral.com. Auto Central, powered by Auto Trader on CliffCentral.com.
Right, folks, good morning. Welcome to Auto Central, brought to you by Auto Trader, your trusted motoring marketplace. Again, back in studio and ready for another hour of motoring entertainment. In studio with me today, George and Martin. How are you doing, guys?
How's the time?
Hey, boys.
How are you doing?
Can you?
Magic weekend?
Lovely weekend.
Fantastic. Yeah. That's a very fancy camera you have there.
To take photos of you, Tom.
Thanks very much, George. I was waiting for that. I feel like I've been put on the spot here. Well, let's jump straight into it, guys. The first thing that we're going to discuss here is, and I'm going to ask it as a question first, is if and don't have a look at what I put out there, but who do you think are the worst drivers in the world? By brand and model type.
Let's define who first. So what do you mean by who? Who as in car or who as in people?
Who as in, okay, so you get a specific type of person who drives a specific type of car, vehicle.
Yeah.
Okay, so what I want you to tell me is what you think the brand is.
The car brand
yeah, of the worst drivers.
Okay. I'm not going to look at the show notes.
And then secondly, you can have a harbour at what colour car thinks gets the most fines, or who the worst drivers are in a particular shade of color of a car, and then the third thing is the model derivative of that brand.
Okay, so let me have a go.
Okay.
I think BMW.
Okay. Yeah.
In South Africa, BMW.
Okay. More?
I'm going to be very unpopular here. Ford Ranger.
Ford Ranger?
Yeah.
Jeez, like, okay, well, let me tell you this. So, analysis, okay, unfortunately, this is not a South African statistic, but analysis of more than 6 million car insurance quotes revealed owners of expensive, fast cars are up to 20 times more likely than those with older, more modest motors to break the rules of the road. The worst offenders are drivers of the BMW 730D.
Hello.
There we go. Uh-huh. So George, you were on the money there.
I was going to say BMW 3 Series drivers.
Yeah, so that's in South Africa.
Yeah,
so that would probably be in South Africa. So this is obviously UK based. So it says the worst offenders are drivers of the BMW 730D. More than a fifth, so 21% of owners who applied for insurance quotes admitted to receiving some form of motoring conviction over the past 5 years. It goes on to say, according to another poll of 2,000 drivers, a third of those are people who drive a grey car.
Yeah. Well, I always say this. There's no black and white. There's only shades of grey.
Right, absolutely.
You know,
yeah.
So maybe the grey guys just don't know, you know, whether they are good drivers or bad drivers.
Yeah, well, also remember white cars and grey cars are the strongest sellers. So I think it's pretty logical.
I would argue that black is in there.
Yeah, well, so it says here that the other high offending colours included black and blue, with a conviction rate of 31% and 29% respectively.
I mean, the most searched for colours are white, silver, black, and, well, I'm guessing grey, but yeah. White, silver and black have always been the most popular
colour cars. Yeah. I think it's because it's...
Well, you have a silver car, you have a white one, I have a silver one.
Exactly.
True.
There we go, three out of three.
And maybe grey is in that silver category.
It could be.
Silver's a very popular.
But why do you think these guys that are driving high end sedans are the worst drivers? Do you think you get to a stage in your life while I've arrived and now I don't actually care? It's funny that it is a premium brand and it's not a three series.
You know what? Maybe it's got something to do with entitlement. You know, people think when they've reached a certain status in life that they've got some sort of entitlement to whatever. But you know what? Surprise, surprise, you don't.
No, you don't.
Well, it's either that or they have to get to the office really quickly to keep on earning that expensive car.
That's very true.
They've
got to pay the bank.
Exactly.
Yeah, so they probably owe the bank more money, which means they have to get to work quicker. So I thought that was quite interesting. Then, a martial artist catches an arrow traveling at 215 kilometers an hour from the sunroof of a vehicle. So Skoda has partnered with two athletes to set a thrilling world record. So martial artist Marcus Haas has caught an arrow from Olympian archer Lawrence Bodolf, fired at a blistering 215 km an hour. And basically what happened is they drove the Skoda past the archer. The archer obviously draws his bow and he unleashes this arrow, traveling at 215 k's an hour, and the guy standing in, well, out the sunroof in the Skoda.
How fast is the Skoda going?
215 k's an hour. So they had to get the aero and the car at the same time. So it took them over 4 months to plan and get this right, and they eventually pulled it off. So I thought that was quite an interesting feat. Yeah. So it took the pair 4 months to prepare, and Haas managed to catch the aero, like I said, standing.
But imagine the wind resistance and you know, incredible force on his body out of that sunroof, and then having to catch that aero.
Still have to catch aero.
I mean,
yeah.
I know flying my aeroplane.
Yeah.
You know, the wind comes past very, very quickly.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know,
well, you just put your hand out the car, like, oh, let's say you're on the highway at
120. Yeah.
You know. Try and put your face out the window at that speed, and then try and doing it like double that, nearly.
Yes, at 215 k's an hour. Yeah. I mean, I know on a motorbike at high speed, your head wobbles.
Yes.
Because of the
wind resistance, you know, on it pushing you left and right.
Well, sure, this Marcus Haas dude probably had some protein reinforcement from some buggies and stuff.
Yeah, exactly. A couple of bugs in the teeth and stuff. But you probably wore those. I mean, you obviously fly with goggles and stuff when you're in the micro lights.
Well, it depends on which airplane I'm flying. Yes. If I'm in the micro light, I've got a full face helmet on. Okay. So, but the wind is still. I mean, there's a visor that deflects the wind off me, but at one stage I didn't have that visor on, and it's windy.
Yeah.
I mean, the microlite does about 120 k's an hour.
Oh, really? That quick?
Yeah, 100 between, it varies between 100 and 120 k's an hour, and that wind is quick. In the Cheetah, it's a different story.
Are we getting off the topic now? Can you glide in that if you lose engine failure?
Any aeroplane can glide. Yeah.
Okay.
As a matter of fact, a Boeing 747 has got a very good glide ratio.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Very good glide ratio. But it's traveling incredibly fast, which is part of the problem. Yeah. You hit something at 400 k's an hour, and
you're gonna know all about it.
Whereas I'm hitting stuff at maybe 200 k's an hour.
You'll see. Well, let's hope you guys aren't hitting anything when you fly, because that's the last thing that you want to be doing.
Yep.
Gents, worst traffic in South Africa. So, Capetonians, I'm sorry to be the bearer of bad news, but we all know that bogged down in traffic can have a huge effect on your work and your personal life, and not only to mention the detrimental effects it has on the overall economy. But Cape Town motorists spend an average of 42 minutes bogged down in peak hour traffic each day. And this is a report that comes from TomTom. And this means that Cape Townian road users will spend the equivalent of 6 days stuck in traffic each year. I mean, just sitting in your car for 6 days. That's
well, you know, you talk about that. It was in the days of Windows 95. And if you calculated the number of years that you waited for Windows to boot up.
Oh, my gosh.
Okay.
Yeah.
One of the reasons I use Mac.
Yeah.
Well, if you just counted all of that over, somebody did some math calculation over time, and waiting for Windows to boot up and shut down was 3 years of your life.
Oh, no.
If you calculated all of the time
that you'd be using
3 years of your life.
I remember
looking
those
at the screen. You know, whereas now in today's Mac days,
you just close it and open it again. And it's
to spend that amount of time in traffic is just ludicrous.
Well, listen, we don't have it that bad, but let's just run through it here. So quickly, so Cape Town, extra travel time during morning, you're looking at an average of 42 minutes a day. Johannesburg, 37 minutes. Yeah. East London, 32 minutes. Pretoria, also 32 minutes. Durban, 26 minutes. And Bloemfontein, 18 minutes.
So let's go live in Bloem.
Well, I'd rather deal with the traffic.
Yep.
No offense to Bloem, it's a beautiful city, but I don't know. Not for me. But it could be worse. You could live in China, where the world's longest traffic jam is a recurring nightmare for Chinese motorists. So imagine sitting in traffic for 12 days.
What?
This nightmare happened in China a few years ago, and insane traffic jams are still plaguing Chinese motorists. They have a 50-lane highway. I mean, just think about that. 50 lanes. So a 50-lane highway turns every driver's worst nightmare into reality. It's a recurring problem, but in 2010, the massive tie-up came due to road construction and compounded by transportation network. But, Joe, it lasted for 12 days.
Where do people get out of their car and walk home?
Guys got out of their cars. They were literally doing a kilometer in a 12-hour period. So, you know, the cars were just like a proper gridlock, and it took them 12 days to clear it.
Wow.
Yeah.
No, thanks.
Okay, I will never complain about the traffic on the way here again.
Listen, I'm stuck in traffic. I'll see you in 2 weeks. Cheers.
It's now 9 o'clock on 9 o'clock on a Monday. I'll see you for the next episode.
Yeah, absolutely. But if you think about it, that's what it is. It's a 2 week traffic jam. So that's quite interesting. And then I found a beautiful story last week, and I really thought it was awesome. So here's this elderly lady. Her name is Julia, and she was listening to a radio show.
South African
lady, yes. And she overheard the DJ talking about some high-profile South African businessman who'd bought a number of vehicles for his many wives. Not too many. I mean, you know, I'll give you a guess. But anyway, so she overheard this, and she thought it was absolutely ludicrous. So what she did was, and let me just read the story to you. She says she was sitting listening to the talk show on the radio in her kitchen at home, and the host was remarking about how much a well-known public figure spent on cars for his wives. She says she was incensed about this expense and thought it was ridiculous. So on the spur of the moment, she called the radio station and told them that she was 80 years old and that her Toyota was 20 years old. So they have a combined age of 100, and they were both 100%. So much so that she is going to drive her car from Cape Town to London to visit her daughter. And she started to get phone calls from her friends and relatives and family saying, is this true? And she said, absolutely. And this 80-year-old woman has driven her car solo trip by herself to London to visit her daughter, and she's driving it back home. Yeah. Amazing. I mean, I couldn't believe it. Sure. So in June 2017, Julia Albu turned the ignition of her beloved 1997 Toyota Corolla, marked locally as the Toyota Conquest, and drove away from her home in Cape Town, South Africa. She was 80 years old. The car was 20 years old, and the commemoration of the century of combined existence was to keep motoring north until she reached her daughter's house in London, England.
I see here in an interview. She said, they asked her, why did she do it? She said, well, my partner of 33 years has recently died. I was broken. I couldn't knit. But I thought if I could research how to do it and team up with my favorite charity, I might be able to do some good for the world.
Absolutely. I mean, isn't that a lovely story?
Absolutely. Amazing.
And I think it just goes to show you. I mean, you know, if someone had to say to you randomly, yeah, now I'm going to drive my Toyota Corolla or Conquest to London, you'd probably, you know, laugh at them. But, from the story, she had some modifications done. She had the vehicle obviously lifted a bit because she's obviously having to travel through Africa. Mm. And this beautiful old woman just went and absolutely smashed it out the park. And
let's see what that route was.
I haven't seen the exact map, but I know that she obviously traveling through Africa, she went through some dodgy stops and had be rerouted and, you know, like a detour, like another.
Talking about Uganda and Sudan and so on. So she didn't really stick to the nice touristy spots either.
Yeah, I think she's pretty much gone the road less traveled.
Indeed.
Eh? Absolutely. Mm, wow. So well done. Well done to Julia. I think that really, really is awesome. And nice to know that you can do that and you don't have to be 20 or 30 or 40. Mm, you know, you can be 80 years old and actually go, you know, it's
time. And it also proves what we've been saying about Tazzers all along. They just don't die.
They just carry on running. Hey? Absolutely. So that was
that was the popular car when I was I was 19. In all of my friends, everyone had Toyota Tazza. So I got a Honda Ballot.
Yep. I had a City Golf.
My first one was a Beetle, so I can't compare. But anyway, so that's just some news out of the world of motoring this week. George, as we do, there was obviously a Russian Grand Prix this weekend, and let's get your thoughts on what went down and what else is happening. What else is happening in the world of Formula One?
What struck me like the most, besides the race itself, is that I suppose I can say this at the tip of Africa, it's very far from Russia.
Yes,
is that Mr. Vladimir Putin was front and center, and right there, and handed out the trophy. I don't know if you saw, handed out the trophy at the end to the winner, and was front and center. I tell you what, I don't think Russia sneezes without Mr. Putin knowing about it.
No, I don't think he knows exactly what's happening in every nook and cranny of that country.
Exactly. Anyway, but besides that, I think, we were chatting about it just now. Right at the beginning of the season, Mercedes was the stronger team. They had the stronger car. It was faster. It was faster down the straights, if you remember.
Yes.
Red Bull's always been, you know, very quick through, you know, through the high downforce, less straights, you know, those kinds of tracks. And then Ferrari kind of had some upgrades.
Yeah.
Over the last couple of races, and became. And they were faster than Mercedes-Benz.
Yes.
And the trouble is that that was their window of opportunity to pull a gap.
And they didn't.
And they didn't. And the reason they didn't is because they're making these strategic decisions, bad strategic decisions. You know, last race, or two races ago, the Raikkonen was on pole. That shouldn't have happened.
Yeah.
You know, they shouldn't have allowed Raikkonen to slipstream Vettel to get onto pole. And now Mercedes has come with some more upgrades to their car, and now the cars, now the two cars are neck and neck. I wouldn't be surprised. It looked to me like Mercedes was faster yesterday.
Yeah.
Just the car itself, besides the driver.
Yeah.
I mean, the way Hamilton passed Vettel was unbelievable.
I did see that.
It was a really, really good move.
Yeah.
You know, and then if I had to compare Vettel, and I'm a Vettel supporter, so okay. You know, yeah, I'm trying to be pragmatic.
Sure.
But if you listen to the way Hamilton talks and the stuff, I mean, sometimes he can get a little bit emotional and childish, but it doesn't happen very often.
Yeah.
And he's absolutely focused.
Mm.
He is 120% focused. And what he does leading up to the race, you know, I don't know, but I'm pretty sure he's got some routines going. Whether Vettel is as focused or not, I don't know. You know, but Hamilton, you can see his demeanor, his attitude. Mm. He's just focused on one thing,
yeah.
And that is getting through those corners as fast as he possibly can.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I don't think Ferrari's going to win this.
I don't think so.
I don't think so. But Verstappen, he did a phenomenal job yesterday. Started at the back.
Yes, I saw that. I mean, he jumped eight places in the first lap.
In the first seven laps, I think he came up 14 places or 13 yes. places or something in the first seven laps. I mean, their car is faster than the backmarkers, or let's not call them backmarkers, but you know, the Red Bull is faster. But and then Daniel Ricciardo, you wonder why he didn't do the same, but he had a damaged wing from the start,
yeah.
so he was detrimented by the damaged wing. But Verstappen really, really did a good job yesterday. I mean, to end up coming through the field the way he did was absolutely phenomenal.
Yeah.
But again, you know, it's the Mercedes is running away with the championship because they just seem to be a more focused, cohesive
yeah.
team that makes the right strategic decisions. I don't know if you saw Hamilton's pit stop yesterday. Vettel passed him in the pit stop,
yeah.
the strategic
yeah.
pit stop.
Yeah.
And as Hamilton came into the pits, I mean, and Mercedes did this to Ferrari 2 weeks back, I think. But so you can't really say that the one does it and the other one doesn't.
Mm.
But as Hamilton came into the pits, they did a dummy pit stop for Raikkonen.
Okay.
So what happens there is the driver leaving the Mercedes pit stop has to drive around the mechanics.
Yes.
Whereas if there's no one in the pit lane,
he can just
go straight through.
Yeah.
So they made it hard for him to get out of the pits, and then Vettel passed him. But within a couple of corners, he got his own back and he passed Vettel again. So
yeah.
So I'm an avid Vettel supporter. I'll support whichever Ferrari driver is number one.
Yeah.
Whether that's Vettel or whether that's Leclerc next year.
Mm.
But I just don't think Ferrari is going to take this one.
No, I don't think so either. Mm-hmm. And then, I mean, obviously afterwards I saw Lewis Hamilton, you know, they're obviously interviewing him stuff, and he just said it was like a bittersweet moment for him. He understands it.
Mm.
I think he appreciates...
Well, you're talking about the Bottas switch.
Yes.
So you know, just so that everybody kind
yeah.
of like that didn't watch the race. So because Hamilton had blistering on his back tyres, Bottas was in the lead,
mm-hmm.
and they strategically switched them
yeah.
so that Hamilton would be in the lead to
mm.
try and make sure that Hamilton
yeah.
You know, won the race, and Bottas should have won that race.
Yeah. But you know, like the guys were saying, you know, if you caught any of the highlights and stuff this morning, that you know, this team has a job to deliver a championship
yeah.
to the Daimler board, and
exactly.
that is the primary objective here, and that's to win.
Win the drivers and the constructors.
Correct.
Yeah. And then I don't know if you heard the team principal of Red Bull, and his name has now just gone out of my head. Speaking about the penalties that Red Bull has got.
Oh, because they used all the engines.
They used the new engines. So they got penalties. That's why they were at the back of the grid. But I agree with him. He spoke about why penalize the drivers. Why not just penalize the team by taking points away?
Yeah.
Because that will hurt their income at the end of the day. Because they get paid based on where they rank in the championship at the end. But leave the drivers in the grid slots that they qualify in.
Yes.
Rather than, because, you know, if a driver replaces an engine and he's number two on the grid for the start of the race, and he changes the engine, he has to go to the back. And that's not fair, you know. So rather penalize the team through points than penalize the driver who's done a good job and got onto the got onto the grid.
Did they? Because they obviously tested in those vehicles.
Yeah.
Obviously.
Yeah. But I mean, if they have to replace the engine, they have to replace it. Otherwise, they're just going to be out of the race, you know.
So is it home and dry yet for McLaren?
No, it's not home and dry. But I just, unless Ferrari pulls a rabbit out of a flipping hat.
Do they even have even a mathematical chance left, Ferrari?
I honestly think yes they do, because what are the points for number one?
I'm not sure.
Yeah, I think they do have a mathematical chance. I'll get back to you in a second, but I think it's to the wire. If you know, one or two more races and they pull the moves that they're pulling, or not pulling the moves they should be pulling, you know, I think it's going to be tickets.
So that's pretty much what's happened this weekend from an F1 point of view, and nice to know that it isn't finished. But I kind of feel like, you know,
it feels like it's
McLaren
finished.
Are gonna, you know, they've got it in the bag. So
McLaren, Mercedes.
Sorry, my bad. Yes.
Used to be McLaren.
So not in the bag yet, but close. Right, let's move on to our next subject. Listen, a lot of people, driving in a car is not really a healthy activity. Would you say so?
It's especially bad for blood pressure.
It's bad for blood pressure. It's bad for stress. It's if you're sitting in traffic, you're not really burning any calories. But this is all about to change. So the Fitcar PPV, brainchild of Saudi-based inventor Nasser Al Shawaf, who together with Dutch engineering partner PBO, is the world's, well, they've developed the world's first calorie-burning car. And essentially what they've done is this car is powered as normal, delivering manufactured specification performance and economy, governed by an active pedaling motion instead of the conventional depressing of an accelerator. So you don't sit in this vehicle and put your right foot, you know, pedal to the metal. You actually
work.
You pedal. You ride. You're riding while you're sitting behind the wheel of the driver's seat. So what they've had to do is they've obviously had to create space for this mechanism. They've taken the brake away and they've put a handheld brake in this car. But you essentially pedal this vehicle. And it does generate normal speed. You can still do 120, 130 k's an hour. So it's obviously, you know, I don't know how that mechanically all works. But yeah, you pretty much pedal this vehicle.
Yeah, it probably senses the speed of the driver's pedaling and then decides whether it should slow down or speed up.
Yeah. What are you gonna say? I don't think this is something that's gonna latch on. You know, there might be, you know, one or two people who are like, you know,
it's a cool novelty, and I think maybe for serious cyclists.
Yeah, no, exactly.
But for the rest of us, I mean, we complain about pressing the clutch in traffic. So now imagine having to pedal just to make your car move, just to instruct your car's engine to make some power to get you moving.
Yeah, stop, start. I don't know if you'd want to be doing this in traffic. Or
how much of a gimmick is it?
Well, listen, I mean, they're saying that you can burn 300 calories an hour, right? Per 30 minutes. Sorry, so let's 600 calories in an hour.
Yeah.
I don't know. Wake up, go to gym, ride your bike, and then just get in the
car. Exactly. I'd rather after gym stop right in front of the door so I don't have to walk too far, and then go burn my 600 calories and then go home.
Exactly.
Taking my car for a ride.
I think it's a cool concept, but it doesn't inspire me with wanting to sit in my car and pedal.
However, you know, maybe for your beloved electric cars.
Why?
put some extra power in the battery to drive the aircon, for instance. So the more you pedal, the colder the aircon
works.
Oh,
my gosh. Here we go. Take the gloves off, gents.
Oh, my goodness me.
Yeah, I don't know. And yeah. Funny enough,
maybe
they've done
should,
this.
Maybe we should put that on the oil pump for Martin's car.
But not again. Remember, I have an old Land Rover.
Exactly.
Oh my gosh. Anyway, so yeah, I just thought that was. I don't think it's going to cotton on. But you know, there are some strange cats out there who would probably think that that's amazing. Then, guys, what I want to get into is just a little bit of consumer advice here. There is an article on Autotrader site, and it was written by our lovely journalist Anae Theron. And Theron, and she's given us 5 tips in terms of what you can do to increase the value of your pre-loved car. So I just thought maybe we could chat about that, because I think that's, you know, there's some good advice, I think, in the market that we're in at the moment. We know that used cars are obviously, you know, very, very popular at the moment. And I think if you are looking to get into a new second-hand car, which will still be new for you, what can you do when you're selling your vehicle to ensure that you get best bang for buck? So let's just start with the list that Anae's put together, and I'm sure we can add to this.
I don't know if the term increase value of a pre-loved car is probably get maximum value.
Yes, get maximum. Well, as close to market-related as
price
possible.
As possible. Yes. Because, you know, you can't increase the price of something when there is a, you know, a certain demand in the market. You know, most consumers put downward pressure on prices. You know, you're not going to walk into a shop and say, I'll pay more.
No, absolutely
so,
not.
Yeah. So there's always downward pressure on prices. So this is more related to how can I realize the maximum value for my car?
Yeah.
And I think the things Anae unpacks here are absolutely valid.
So let's jump in here with point number one, and that's to have a professional valet done if you can. And let's just talk about that. I mean, Anae talks about this.
I mean, it's pretty obvious. A nice looking and a nice smelling car just makes the driver feel better about the car.
Yes.
If
you drive a clean car, you feel better.
Exactly.
Right? Absolutely.
So
there's nothing
even
worse
if,
than getting
even if it's
a
an old Land Rover.
Car. Even if it is an old Land Rover.
No, that's not good.
You can't wash the Land Rover because it's got holes in the roof.
Is it that army brown?
You know, it's blue with a white roof.
Oh, two-tone.
Oh, wow.
Yeah,
okay.
Two-tone. Very 80s. And actually, Tom's correct. There's a huge gap between the roof and the doors.
You can't go wading.
I can't go near it. No, I can wade. It's fairly well sealed at the bottom. Oh. Just nowhere near the top.
Oh, okay.
So if it rains or a car wash, anything of that sort. And that's why I don't wash it. Because the mud and the rust keeps it together.
Absolutely. Fantastic.
So if you want maximum value for your Land Rover, wash it.
No, because then they'll see the dings and the scratches and the rust.
You probably find a Land Rover would sell better if it's got dirt on it. It comes with the fact
because
that
it proves that it can work.
Wasn't there at some point in South Africa where people were spraying mud on
their
cars?
Yeah,
it was like a
fake mud.
Yeah,
I've actually seen wraps these days that do exactly that as well.
Fake mud wraps.
I mean, my word.
Anyway, that's not going to help.
So wash the car.
So wash your car and also make it smell nice.
Yes, absolutely. Because
you don't want to smell cigarette smoke or spilt milk or eggs or anything in that car when you get into it.
I don't know if you can get that cigarette smoke out of the car, that smell, can you?
You can.
You know, it must.
But it takes like a $600 valet where they take out every single seat
and they really lift the carpets and drench it and get it cleaned properly.
And then the roof lining is almost guaranteed to fall down as well.
Yeah.
So, I mean, Anae speaks about low cost odor busters here, like charcoal. I know charcoal absorbs junk. So you could put charcoal in the car. I mean, somebody said to me, if you want to get the smell out of your fridge, put a raw onion. Or half a cup of vinegar. Maybe that'll work. You know what the worst thing is in a car if you spill it? Milk.
Yeah. Yes.
And my word.
Yes.
One day I spilled milk many, many years ago in one of my cars. On the.
You didn't cry, hey?
No.
Because you don't cry.
It wasn't spilled milk like that. No, but it was in the passenger footwell.
Yeah.
And the milk spilled.
Okay, so here's a pro tip. You clean it up with soap and water and let it dry. And then you dab it with a vinegar, a cloth soaked in vinegar. And the vinegar actually decomposes the proteins in the milk, which makes it smell.
Which causes the smell.
So your car will smell like vinegar for a day or two, and then everything goes away.
Lovely. I should have done that.
There's a pro tip for you. Works for eggs as well.
Really?
Yes. Ask me how I know.
You dropped eggs in your car. Yes.
Oh gosh, that must be crazy. My father had a friend who went on a hunting trip, and they obviously took vinegar to cure the meat from the animals. But he spilt, it was 10 liters
of vinegar
in the boot of a Mercedes that had apparently it shot electronics and it really cocked the car up.
So a rag soaked with vinegar, not 10 liters of vinegar.
So we're not washing the car in vinegar; we are dabbing it. Okay, cool. So that was that. Okay, the second point here: repair paint. Work scratches and chips, torn upholstery, replace weather beats and wipers, weathered floor mats, and anything that is bad for your car's overall image. And I think this is really important because if you're selling something, I mean, how far would you go?
I think the devaluation of a car with simple things like a slight stone chip or a slight dent, you know, the amount of money that it costs to repair those small things. I'm not talking about the big things. You get more back on the car if those things are repaired, because it's less about the actual repair and more about the hassle that the new owner is going to go through. You want to get a little dent repaired, you got to take time to do that. If that's already done and the car's, you know, in good shape, you're going to get your value for the car.
See, a car is always worth more if it creates the perception that it was well looked after.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which leads us to the next point.
Yeah. Well, I mean, just on that point, I mean, you don't want to be. I mean, I'm dealing with a situation at the moment because I got a beautiful 6-year-old who he wasn't 6 when he did it. He was probably 3. Thought it would be fun to push his bike in between the two cars that were in the garage, and we had parked in such a way that the width of the handlebars was probably exactly like there was probably like 3 mils on
either
side.
And then he was forcing it through.
And he didn't have the rubbers on so there were scratches down both vehicles. And he just looked as if to say, well, why did you park like idiots? Anyway, so getting into repair. But that's the thing, I don't see anybody buying that vehicle unless I fix that scratch.
Yeah.
Because you don't want to be like, oh, I've just bought this, and then your mates are like,
well, yeah, I mean, you're gonna have a situation where the buyer is gonna say, I've got to repair that scratch, you know, take 1,000 rand off, it might cost you 500 rand to fix.
Correct.
You know, and people work with round numbers usually, usually comes down by a grand.
All right, let's have a look at point number 3. Have the documentation to prove that your car was properly maintained. Really, really important. I think, I think that's one of the first questions that anybody asks when they're buying a second-hand vehicle.
Service history.
Does this car have a service history and who with? So that's really important. Do you think there's a little bit of leeway nowadays if you're still getting the vehicle serviced at a private workshop versus a dealer? If your car's out of warranty, let's say.
I think the perception of having a full service history from a dealership, no matter what the age of the car, does create comfort.
Yes.
Might not necessarily be, true, because there are a lot of,
really good
workshops out there that do, as good a job as a franchise dealer would do. But the perception of the franchise dealership is where I think the value lies.
Yeah, but it's a bit of a double-edged sword, that one, because servicing your car at the dealership when it's out of warranty and out of service plan, out of motor plan, will cost you a lot more. And if you have to do this for 3 or 4 years, you will end up spending more on servicing at the dealership than you'll get back on resale value.
True.
Yeah.
So there's a tipping point. I'd say you're around the 4 or 5 year old mark.
Yeah,
you can start taking your car to
you take the car to wherever you want, I guess.
Sure.
But when the car gets out of warranty, I guess that's when you've got to start asking yourself the questions Martin is asking. What is the return? What is the benefit versus the cost? So what is the service cost at this place? What is the service cost at that place? And how much is the car devaluing?
Absolutely. Another important thing is a lot of workshops and garages where you can have your car fixed are kind of endorsed by Some of the OEMs. So these guys are affiliated to the likes
Well, not necessarily, but if they're accredited by, let's say, the RMI, then at least if this is an RMI accredited workshop servicing the car, it counts just about as much as having it done at the dealership. But at a far, far less severe cost.
So you're going to be out of a little bit less out of your pocket.
Yeah, I'd say the tipping point there lies around the 4 or 5 year old mark.
That's just out of warranty, I guess.
Just out of warranty.
Out of warranty. But then you know, you got to ask yourself: do I replace the car? Do I, you know, do I continue to fit the bill for the expense of potentially repairing it? You know, my philosophy is the best kind of car is the one that's paid for.
Yep.
Absolutely.
Like a Land Rover.
No, it's not the best kind of car for anything except sitting pretty in the garage, marking its territory with oil. Sentimental reasons.
Sentimental reasons.
Yeah.
The gap in the door.
That's why my daddy drives a little Toyota.
I told you,
I have to have something that I know will start every time.
Ah, okay.
And will actually get me there. But
Well, I can't wait to see this. I think we've heard a lot about it. I think it's time you
also bring, some pictures.
Pictures. Why don't you bring it to the office?
I've broken as usual in the garage.
All right, let's get on to the last point here. And I thought this was quite interesting. Don't look like you're desperate to get rid of your car. Once your car is squeaky clean, leave a few personal belongings inside. Now, I'm not sure what Anae was referring to, but I kind of get her point. It's like, you're more than welcome to drive my car. Don't come across as I need to sell it today. Do you think that makes a difference? I mean,
it's like when you walk into someone's home, the home must look like it's lived in.
Yes.
So your car must look like you drive it.
Yes.
You know, I mean, don't leave the McDonald's packets in the passenger. Yeah, you know, absolutely. So keep the car tidy and clean, but if it's got absolutely nothing in it, you know, then it could be on a showroom floor.
Could be on a showroom floor. So I wonder what she was getting at. I mean, like pens, pencils, box of tissues.
Yeah, something like that.
Dice on the mirror.
Yeah, a couple of
fur on the dash.
Fur on the dash.
We're definitely selling this car at 16.10, I'm telling you now.
16.10 forever.
Forever. Anyway, so those are 5 tips. So yeah, if you want to have a squiz, hop onto autotrader.co.za, look under the news and review section, and Anae does unpack a fantastic article here that will actually just help you, you know, get hopefully closer to retail value than what you might have got without reading the article. Right, this is going to. I thought this. You know what? It's really important that we talk about it. But we all know what happened with our constitution. 2 weeks ago with the decriminalization of the use of cannabis in your private and personal use. In a private residence. But we do know that there are chances out there, and I just think it's right that this hands down does not mean that you can light one up and go for a joyride.
No,
it's not happening.
Nope.
So I just think that's something that you know, it's only right that we tell people that this is a no-no, because it will, you know, impair your response time, your vision.
No,
you know,
definitely.
When you're driving, I mean, like, you know, it's. You know, I think some people take driving for granted, like, oh no, I'm just, you know, but you really are operating a heavy piece of equipment, and you shouldn't be doing it under the influence of anything.
My worry around this is that how do you test for it on the side of the road?
That's the one problem. The other problem is, now I see here in this article, it says that one in every 6 drivers involved in a fatal crash tested positive for marijuana.
Yeah, that's in the States.
In the States. But now there's one problem with this.
Yes.
You could test positive for marijuana 2 weeks after.
Because it stays in
you. And by that time, that driver is not stoned at all anymore.
Exactly, yeah. So how do you know? They're going to have to come up with a way to, like, test on the breathalyzer you know, thing that they do, you know, so where you can test that, I don't know. I don't even know what it's called.
No, neither do I.
The levels of THC in your body.
Can you test via your breath for THC?
No, most likely.
I don't think so.
If you can't, it's probably in development.
Yeah, I suppose. I mean, I wonder if they could probably do like a you know how they test for glucose and cholesterol and stuff?
Where you just a little pinprick.
Pinprick and they can tell you if you've got a certain amount in your system that, you know, you've obviously been using, but you used with it. We can tell that you used it in the last hour or 2 hours or whatever it is. So they are going to have to come up with something to make sure that we don't have, you know, because that's just going to slow traffic down.
Yeah.
It's going to slow it down. You know, I'm going to be doing 80 Ks on the highway.
And really, really relaxed.
Absolutely.
Super so I think the takeaway from this is don't light up and drive.
Yeah, don't smoke and drive.
Don't smoke and drive.
All right, fantastic. Well, let's get on to our
Have you seen the vape and drive?
Every day.
I'm on the highway and, you know, these guys with these vapes. You know, whether they're better or worse than cigarettes, I have no idea because I've never smoked. But, you know, you see this plume of smoke.
It's crazy.
I'm pretty sure that's dangerous in itself because you've got to look through this mist.
Absolutely. Yep. I don't get it. I mean, they have games and stuff now. There's guys who do vaping.
Yes. There's vape competitions.
Vape competitions, all that kind of stuff. And you can see oaks, like, really in traffic.
That
you
just
actually
sounds
lose
so
the driver
sad.
For a second or two.
And then it's like, you know, it's almost like the smoke that comes off the, you know, aeroplanes when they're doing aerobatic shows coming out the window of the car.
No, absolutely. It's exactly like it is. I mean, I remember being a kid, my uncle smoked, and he used to be able to blow rings and used to do all sorts of things.
And
I thought that was cool, and now vaping's just taken that to a whole new level. But, again, when I see guys doing it in shopping centres and stuff, it's like... You're walking around blowing your air out, man.
I don't actually mind that because it generally smells like cookies.
No. Listen, cookies and cream. Fazana, what other flavors do we get there?
Oh, there's way too many flavors. There's so many dessert flavors. There's so many mixed fruit flavors.
Do you vape?
I do.
Do you? I didn't know that.
I recently started, but yeah. No, there's some...
Were you a smoker before that?
No.
No. No, so you just started vaping.
I'm just a vapor.
Yeah.
Talking about vapors, and before we get into the car review, I am very, very pleased to announce that we have got a competition going live on Auto Trader during the course of today, and we have partnered with Sony Entertainment and with the launch of the new Venom movie, and we're running a competition on our site. We'll obviously give you all the information that you need to find out about it on our social media channels. But essentially what we're doing is we're asking you 14 questions a day. 14 questions, one question a day for 2 weeks. And we're giving away 14 Daniel Klein watches valued at about 1,500
Rand,
if I'm not mistaken.
Nice.
And Venom hampers, which are valued at about $700. So all in all, about a 2,000 Rand prize. And we're giving 14 of those away over the next 14 days.
Nice.
So what you'll have to do, the instructions are on the site. Obviously, you're going to have to watch the trailer. And we've got a question around the movie every single day. And you'll log on to Auto Trader, you're going to answer the question on our competition page, and yes, if you subscribe to our newsletter, you automatically qualify if you answer, because that was your criteria. You have to sign up to our newsletter, and but a really, really nice 14 prizes, 14 days, awesome competition, and I think it's going to be a really, really good movie.
Nice.
I've seen the trailer and stuff, so happy days. Right, let's chat Opel Grandland X. Tell us a little bit about it, Mart.
I have to admit, this car left me feeling a little bit ambivalent.
Okay.
That's a big word.
That's a big word.
Ambivalent. Four syllables.
Yeah. My, it's a new record for me. Not bad for a blonde, eh?
Don't think Donald Trump will get that one.
No.
On the one hand, it's actually a really nice car to live with. It's agreeable, it's comfortable, and it's spacious, and it's practical and everything. It just felt a little bit bland when I was driving it.
In terms of performance specifically,
okay. Yes, but also, I mean, it does everything reasonably well, but it doesn't excel at anything.
Okay.
In particular.
Okay.
So about the technical details, the Grandland X is only available with one engine and gearbox. It's a 1.6 liter turbo and a 6-speed auto.
Why is there any electric in there?
No, sorry, George.
It looks nice though. You know what it looks like?
Like an Opel SUV?
No. An existing car on the road, Martin. It looks like the Hyundai Tucson.
Or the Kia Sportage. Yeah. I mean, obviously it's going up against these cars.
It's going up against those cars.
Yeah.
Very nice look, though.
Personally, I think the appearance is its strongest suit. A lot of onlookers said, yeah, it looks a bit conservative and so on. Nah. I actually think it looks really, really good. And when you get inside, it's the same story. There's no specific item or design cue to grab your attention, but it's a very blends. Homogeneous, pleasing kind of hole.
Another four-syllable word.
Mm. Yeah.
Mark, you're on fire today.
homogeneous.
Yeah. And you know, if you look at the outside and the inside, you can see it's clearly an Opel.
Yeah.
Except that it actually isn't. Underneath, it's a Peugeot. Now, think back a year or two ago.
That's French and German.
That's correct. So it's Eisbein and Dijon mustard, which should be a nice combination.
Foie gras.
So underneath, the chassis and the platform is all Peugeot 3008, which was a Car of the Year finalist for 2018, and it actually got very good reviews.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's definitely competent underneath.
Yeah.
It rides reasonably well. It handles fairly well for such a spacious and reasonably heavy vehicle.
But why the underlying French influence?
It's very obvious in the transmission and in the engine.
But why?
All right. Now, long before General Motors sold Opel to Peugeot, they actually started this collaborative program.
Okay. Because, so I mean, you can't just sell a company and integrate like that.
No.
So it has to have come from...
Exactly. You know. So there was a bit of a run-up to this. And it clearly shows. I mean, it looks like an Opel, and inside it looks like an Opel, and it feels like an Opel when you touch anything as well.
Yeah.
But it was purely based on the Peugeot 3008's platform. So, I mean, that already tells you it's not a bad car. It's more than competent. The problem is other Opels, such as the new Astra and the Atom and the little Corsa as well, they have this almost Germanic feel to them where they concentrate on performance and dynamics and driver involvement and everything else.
Yeah.
Whereas the Peugeot engine and gearbox is much, much softer, and it's geared towards smoothness more than anything else.
Hmm.
So what we have here is a car that looks stylish but conservative.
Okay.
Sounds like you're on the fence.
And it drives kind of like a wet rag. The engine is soft and the gearbox is soft.
At least those were two single syllable words.
I mean, you've had some. I mean, you're driving something at the moment that you know is in comparison to the
Hyundai Tucson.
He's in the new Hyundai Tucson, and I mean, you were telling me, you know, outside that it's just so responsive. It's, it feels like it's a car that wants to go when you put your foot down. Those, you know, it's a front wheel drive only.
And you talk about the Tucson.
The Tucson.
No, the Tucson is really, beautiful.
Really,
yeah.
And it's
beautiful.
Really nice to drive. And you know, mainly because the engine and the gearbox are both so responsive. Whereas in this Peugeot, the power is there, but when you stand on the throttle or you like try and provoke it to make some power, the gearbox takes a deep breath and it considers very carefully which gear it should take.
Yeah.
And then it smoothly selects it, and then it eventually sends a signal to the engine, okay, I need some more power now.
And by that time, the hot blonde that you were checking out the robot is already 300 meters ahead of you.
Exactly.
Now, we can't have that.
No, we can't.
We really
just
can't.
So I think the biggest issue with this Opel is the engine and the gearbox is a bit limp.
The engine and the gearbox.
And the gearbox.
That's the combination, entire drivetrain.
That's the thing. The combination of the two.
Yeah.
So, as I said in my report, it's live already. As I said in the report,
yes.
Perhaps a more potent engine or a livelier feeling engine and a more responsive gearbox or a manual even.
I don't know.
Change the car's personality.
You think the gearbox can make that big a difference when the engine is lacking?
No, look, the engine makes up 121 kilowatts, so it's not lacking. It's not really lacking.
Yeah.
But the gearbox does its absolute best to suck every little bit of life out of that engine.
Yeah.
And it's actually so much of a pity because the Opel Astra with a 1.6 turbo engine, but it's not a Peugeot engine.
Yes.
Ah.
Is amazing to drive. It feels responsive and it feels lively, and it actually feels like a performance car, also from a 1.6.
Yeah.
Whereas this, it's, look, it's a great mommy wagon.
Okay.
The only problem is I'm not a mommy.
No, for sure. Listen, but I think to your point now, I mean, you know, and I think we've got to take it from where it comes. I mean, you guys are people who test cars all the time. You these are things that you've learned over years to, you know, to pick up and stuff.
I know what Martin's learned driving Land Rover.
How to park it in the garage.
Pushing a car.
He just likes to look at it when you drive, when you walk through that garage.
That's pretty much, that's all I can do.
But yeah, I think if you're not after performance, and you know, as long as it goes when you need it to go, like you say, it might be a mommy's car, but
it's a beautiful,
great looking car.
Does just about everything well, but it just does so without showing any obvious pride in its work.
I mean, I'm a firm believer in form over function, or form before function.
Yeah.
Because if you get something that works really well and looks shit, nobody's going to be interested in that thing. If you've got something that looks very pretty and is slightly underrated when it comes to its function, you're probably going to get more appeal.
Yeah, you can forgive it.
This is a beautifully looking car. It's a really
My only problem is car. The Hyundai parked outside costs similar money. It's just as good looking. And it's much better to drive.
Well, I mean, Hyundai's impressed me over the last 15, 20 years. I mean, the car, in my opinion, that put Hyundai on the map was the Getz.
Pretty much. That marked the turning point.
That was the turning point of Hyundai. And then they brought out the iX35. It was a nice car. I liked it. But I wasn't entirely impressed. It was a girl's car.
Yeah.
And then they replaced that with this Tucson, which is now either a girl's or a guy's car. And
yeah, no, absolutely.
You know, I think you can style that thing any way you like. I mean, you've seen the what is the term for it? That turbocharged version of the Hyundai.
Oh, the N-Series.
N-Series. It looks beautiful.
Yeah. See, now the problem is this Opel costs 465,000.
Yeah.
Now that's a lot of money, and the Opel is entirely adequate.
Yeah.
And more than adequate in some respects.
Yeah.
But at that price point, you can get one of these Tucsons, or you can get a Volkswagen Tiguan, or you can get a Kia Sportage, or anything else, which does the same job, but with a bit more enthusiasm.
All right, fantastic, Martin. Well, thanks very much for that. That is the
nice try, but no cigar.
Opel Grandland X.
I still think it looks beautiful.
No, it is a last looking car, and your article went live on Friday. So if That's anybody correct. Wants to read that, autotrader.co.za under news and reviews, Martin's article is there, so you can catch it there. Right, guys, let's chat a little bit of tech before we wrap up. More charging stations for electric cars in South Africa, and I think what's really, really important to note is we ran a poll on our site, and 55% of the people, when the question was would you buy an electric car, 55% of the respondents said yes they would, which is really, really good for us, and I think it's great for the South African market that there is enthusiasm for electric cars. And Jaguar has announced that 82 new public charging stations will be installed nationwide as part of its drive to bring the new I-Pace electric vehicle to the country. It is happening. It's rolling out.
Lovely.
We're seeing it. It's live. We're living this revolution. Of the motor industry, much to, you know, some people's dismay, but you know what?
Well, I mean, what I like is that 30 million rand is being invested in this infrastructure, which is very, very cool. And if you look at the map and the coverage, you know, it almost looks like in the days of when cell phones first started, and that kind
signal.
Of like where you got signal, and it's right the way down the N1, past Bloemfontein, up to Pretoria, Gaborone, right the way down to Durban. There's a hole between East London and Durban, unfortunately. You guys have to wait. All the way down the Eastern Cape, right into the Western Cape, the Garden Route, and then there's a hotspot there in Windhoek.
Yeah.
For that one oak.
For that one oak.
No, one oak. I'm afraid because it's currently not. Won't make much sense in Namibia.
It's for the guy who's going to trade his Land Rover for an electric car.
Yeah, for an electric car.
Finally
so I see they're rolling out these 30 public charging stations will be erected at various points of convenience, such as shopping centres in the country's major hubs, and that, like George said, Johannesburg, Pretoria, Durban, Cape Town, Port Elizabeth, East London, and Bloem, and then obviously the... the N3 between Gauteng and Durban, then obviously the N1 between Gauteng and Cape Town, which is fantastic. And what's really nice is, as a Jaguar owner, you'll get I think it's 25% discount on your fees. And it says here, with a 90 kilowatt battery, a full recharge in an R-Pace, for example, will cost between 270 and 315 rand. So you're looking at about 3 rand or 3 rand 50 for one kilowatt hour. Of charging, and you can do a full charge. I think this, they said, for the Jag will take about 72 minutes. Sorry, 0 to 80% will take around 72 minutes.
How far can you go with that?
Well, this is the only thing that I couldn't see in the article was, you know, how far. Fast chargers, meaning 100 kilometers of range, will take about 20 minutes. So probably 300 Ks on a full charge. So it's 600 Rand, call it, to get to Durban, which is cheaper than going by petrol.
Much.
Well,
but you're just gonna, it's gonna take a lot longer.
Yeah. I'll take a bit. How often do you stop for coffee? How much do you stop for coffee? And then the question is, what is the range of the cars? And the range of the cars are going to increase over time.
Absolutely, they are going to increase. And I also think, you know, I think a lot of people, I mean, you know, we were always taught this as kids, that the holiday starts the moment you get into the vehicle. It's not when you arrive at the destination. So getting there, you know, extremely urgently is not a point. You should enjoy the drive.
Yeah, I mean, the I-Pace's range is 470 kilometers. So, you know, what do they say? A full charge will take.
So you can still get to Harry Smith, do your 1 hour stop, and get to Durban. And then let the car charge again, because you should just be going to the beach. And
I don't really care how far an I-Pace can go. I have to admit, I think it's a beautiful thing.
It is a beautiful thing.
I don't care how
just
far it can go.
Just say that again and
charge.
Say your name. Martin,
my name is Martin, and I'm a petrol head, but I don't care how far an I-Pace can go. I just look at it and I kind of drool. I think it's a gorgeous looking thing.
Yeah.
Anything with an electric motor.
So hats off to Jag.
Yeah. The old Leaf is cook. The new Leaf is cool. The new Leaf is much cooler. It's not like a Tesla, but if it was Hobson's choice and it was the only one left in the world, I'd drive it.
Absolutely. I agree. Talking about Tesla, I don't know if you saw what happened last week, but Elon put a tweet out saying like they've got a backlog and they can't, you know, they don't know how they're going to get the deliveries done. Do you want to unpack that?
I've got an opinion on this. It's a personal opinion, but let's just get a photograph of Mr. Musk out here, and one day I wish he would tweet me, but let's see.
I wish he'd stop tweeting when he's blazed.
Let's have a look at a recent photograph of Elon Musk. Where do we find? And then I'll show you what I'm talking about. Check this. Have a quick squiz at this. Look at how unhealthy he's looking.
Yeah, he's looking old and he's looking like
he's looking
aged.
Unhealthy. How old is he now? I mean, he's
in his 40s.
He's my age, right?
Yeah.
He's looking incredibly unhealthy. And, I mean, he makes no bones about the amount of hours he works.
Yes.
And the amount of effort he puts in. And hats off to him. He's helping change the world when it comes to electrification of the automotive industry.
Yeah.
And it's great. And then there's been some rumors about, drugs and alcohol and all that stuff. But does a tweet like that come off the back of being tired, not really thinking straight? Did he do it on purpose? Did he kind of regret it afterwards? Who knows? Because surely he must have known that a tweet like that's going to make its stock plummet.
Yeah, look, I think, you know, I think he's obviously feeling the pressure, which is why he put the tweet out. Whether, you know, this is something that the marketing department maybe have said, listen, bang something like this out, let's see what happens.
There's no such thing as negative marketing. You never know.
Absolutely.
You never know.
I mean, it might be on purpose. He put a tweet out to say that, you know, what did he go out and say? We've gone from production hell to delivery logistics hell, but this problem is far more tractable. We're making rapid progress, should be solved shortly. And one of a customer said, a lot of Tesla owners, including myself, would be delighted to volunteer for free to help with deliveries in times like this. We can't do the paperwork, but we can do the orientations, and it's fun to educate new owners and to see their joy and enthusiasm. And I completely get that. I mean, I don't see anything wrong with somebody who owns a Tesla taking a new Tesla owner through the motions.
Yeah, but wasn't the problem taking the company private?
Yeah, that was the problem.
That was the problem.
Where the Securities Exchange Commission complaint came about. And I see now, as a result of that, he has to resign as chairman, although we will stay on as CEO of Tesla. So that's kind of a big knock.
I don't know, I kind of feel for the guy, but like he's gone out with good intentions to make a difference.
I think he's going to go on the map as the one of the people in the world who helped change the world significantly.
Do you think we'll talk about him like we speak about Henry Ford in 30 years' time?
Yeah.
And that's the legacy that
he's going to continue to change the world. He just needs to stop building this deficit by working so many hours.
Yeah.
you know, as CEO myself, I have to keep myself healthy,
yes,
fit, because sometimes the pressure gets so much psychologically, because you have to make the numbers, you have to think about, you know, how to drive a company forward. You've got all these people to worry about. You've got the market to worry about. You've got competition to worry about. And it becomes stressful. I don't know if he's managing his stress properly. You know, and I'm saying that as an outsider.
Sure.
But he's, you know, he's building a deficit. And, you know, why say these things?
Yeah. Anyway, shame. So, I mean, it can't be easy for the guy, but it is what it is, and we'll obviously keep everybody posted on what's going down. Unfortunately,
I hope he pulls it back.
I hope so too. I really do. I think he deserves. He deserves to achieve greatness. Not that he hasn't.
He's already done it.
I just wish
he could get the
people off his back. Exactly.
Yeah. Kind of like an electric motor that's overloaded.
Oh my gosh. On that note, ladies and gentlemen, that was Auto Central. It's 1 minute past 10. We thank you for tuning in again. And our podcasts are available for download on our site. And yeah, that's another Auto Central. Have a fantastic week, everybody.
This is CliffCentral.com.